I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Vancouver Sun's Peter O'Neill joins me now. The veteran Parliament Hill journalist is the author of a new biography, I Am a Métis, The Story of Jerry St. Germain. It's not only a great look at the remarkable life of one of Canadian politics' most influential insiders, but a terrific view onto political history, not only in Ottawa, but British Columbia in the 1980s, 1990s, and into the 21st century. St. Germain's life, which began on the shores of the Assiniboine, the eldest of three kids, the other two being sisters, whose father was a shy Métis trapper and construction worker, gives us a view onto a hardscrabble life that shapes St. Germain's life. There are stints as an Air Force pilot and a police officer and a chicken farmer as well. But it's business that propels him to politics and a seat in the House of Commons from here, the Lower Mainland here in B.C. in 1983 through a role in Brian Mulroney's government when the Progressive Conservative Party wins in 1984. He's finally named to the cabinet in 1988, but is defeated in the free trade election of that year. He goes on to become president of the party, and in those dark years of the 1990s and early 2000s when the right needed uniting, it was by this time Senator St. Germain was at the fore. We see two in the book, his further Senate career during the Harper years and his ongoing work with First Nations. Peter O'Neill has been in Ottawa covering national affairs since 1988. He is the former Paris-based Europe correspondent for Post Media News and was the 2005 recipient of a Jack Webster Award. He also received a Citation of Merit at the 2012 National Newspaper Awards. This new book is published by Harper in Ottawa today. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Peter O'Neill. Mr. O'Neill, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So, in reading your book, I realized as I was reading what a compelling life story Jerry St. Germain has had, and I realized just how a Canadian life story this is. I mean, only in this country could this happen to this one guy.
Absolutely. We can get in this later, but, you know, a Métis born on the outskirts of Winnipeg. He was actually born in the same hospital as my mother, coincidentally. But he grew up poor, so that's one thing. I mean, most countries in the Western world, the wealthy end up in politics, and that was one thing. But secondly, he became successful and famous because of a language crisis and the hanging of Louis Riel, you know, 100 years earlier, that those historical events helped propel him to the kind of prominence you wouldn't normally expect from a guy like him. So, yeah, it was a real story of kind of rags to riches and a classic Canadian, as you say.
Yeah, so in the age of Trump, and we're just coming out of the Harper era, we're thinking a lot about what a conservative is. Well, what sort of conservative was Jerry?
Well, he was a, I would say he's a true conservative from, if you look at the 80s, the 70s, 80s, early 90s, he was a fiscal conservative. He was a small businessman, self-made millionaire who basically had nothing when he arrived in Vancouver because he was a cop before that. And so he believed in small government and lower taxes and less regulation, and that was the era of the Trudeau government, of course, Pierre Trudeau, and you know, big government, bilingualism, biculturalism, multiculturalism, all those things. And so he kind of railed against that, so that honed his beliefs. He was a policeman, so he was kind of a law and order conservative. And socially, he's a devout Roman Catholic, and so he's pro-life, and he doesn't apologize for that. So in that sense, he is a classic and true conservative. But on the other hand, he is not, and he'll say this, he's not comfortable with the kind of some of the hardcore conservatives of the Harper era, you know, the kind of the Jason Kenney kind of people that play this nasty hardball politics, take no prisoners, that came out of the U.S., really. He just he struggles with that. That's one of the differences. And the second one is, his life's work for the last 15, 20 years has been helping Canada's Aboriginal people, of which he is one. But he always denied that in growing up. He was ashamed of being Métis. But as he got older and moved on in his career, he became more cognizant of that side of him and less ashamed and more proud. And he, as a senator, he worked very hard and Jim Prentice, the late Jim Prentice, who died tragically not that long ago, I interviewed him when he was our original affairs minister. He said Jerry was very important in helping Prentice sell to a skeptical caucus the need to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on things like drinking water and housing and things like that on reserves. And so Jerry, in a sense, was the conscience, the social conscience of the conservative caucus.
Yeah, the Prentice tells you in the book that he saw St. Germain embrace his First Nations background a lot more in those years. I guess the Harper government forms in 2006, and Jerry's in the Senate, and he sees that for the first time, I guess, Prentice does, this embrace of his background. Well, what sort of childhood was it for Jerry, and how did that shape him growing up?
Well, he was the oldest of three kids, and his father was literate, I think, but he wasn't learned at all. I'm not sure you know, his level of education. Jerry was a little bit shy about talking about that, but he was a simple man. Jerry adored him. He was a hunter. He was a great hunter and a trapper, and he worked in construction, and he was a bouncer for a while, and so Jerry just adored him. His mother was of French descent, French from France, and she was obviously not Métis, whereas his father was. And they weren't wealthy at all. He talks in the book about having supper one night, and his parents weren't eating. It was a cold night in the middle of winter in their little cabin with the sisters, and he said, "Why aren't you eating?" And they just said, "Not hungry." And they just sat there, and he knew then that they just didn't have enough food. And so I think there were different groups of Métis in that community, which was one of Canada's, the Métis Nation of Canada's oldest communities. It was a very historic community, that area. And there were wealthier and less wealthy people. And so he felt, and there were Francophones there as well, non-Métis Francophones in that area. And he just felt ashamed that he was at the lower rung socially and financially. They weren't dirt poor. They weren't the poorest. But they weren't. He just felt not very proud of his heritage. He had a little bit of knowledge of his background. He told me about when he was 5 years old, he was at a funeral of his for his uncle, I think it was. And there was a photograph, framed photograph of Louis Riel over the casket. And Jerry said to his dad, "Who's that?" And he said, "Son, that's Louis Riel. He was very important for us." And he remembers that. But other than that, he kind of went through most of his childhood and adult life trying to deny that culture. He wasn't proud of it at all.
There's a great line in the book about the relationship between the mother and the father. I forget how it goes. You know, the line about the meek shall inherit the earth, and then Jerry says that his father.
if the meek truly inherited the earth, his father would be the greatest landowner there was. And that's, his father touched him in so many ways. There was I probably wouldn't have written the book had I not heard a story about at his final day in the Senate. People stood up, and you saw that in the introduction.
Yeah.
People gave testimonials. And I kind of reluctantly went over there. I wasn't sure at the time whether I was going to do this big profile that I was writing for the Vancouver Sun in 2012. But I went over, and I was sitting in the gallery, and people were standing up. And then Mobina Jaffer stands up. And, you know, Jerry's a right-wing conservative from B.C. Mobina's a liberal-appointed, left-of-center kind of feminist person. You wouldn't think that they would be close at all. And she tells this absolutely amazing story about how when Jerry was the head of the Chicken Farmer Association of B.C., that her father, and she's an Ismaili Muslim from Uganda, had gone in to get quota, and the Fraser Valley farmers wouldn't give him that quota because they were afraid that all these Muslims coming in were going to take over the industry, and that they were denying it. And he walked in and he saw this older man sitting there, and he walked in and said, "What's going on?" And they explained it to him, and he said, "Give him the quota. He's as equal as the rest of us." And Mobina told that story, and I got choked up because she said, no one stood up for my dad except for Jerry. He stood up against the bigoted farmers of the Fraser Valley. And then I asked Jerry about it in that 2012 interview, and he said, I could see my father sitting right there. That was my dad.
Yeah.
Could have been my dad. And I'm getting choked up now talking about it.
But, no, it is. Yeah. I mean, there's so many beautiful moments in the book about his life, and you talk about that. I mean, he goes into the Air Force, he becomes a cop, and then he goes into business, I guess, in the Coquitlam area, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So what brings him into politics? This would have been the early 80s now, right? 82, 83?
Yes. Yeah, he was always involved in politics. He was known as a kind of a player. He was never he calls them downtowners. He was totally unknown in downtown Vancouver on Howe Street. Mm-hmm. Places like that, but in Coquitlam, he was a player. I think the more of the focus would have been on provincial politics and keeping the NDP out, because he was very anti-NDP. So he was contributing to social credit and helping to raise funds. And of course, he got involved federally. And he wasn't a fan of Trudeau, and he wasn't crazy about Joe Clark back when Joe was leader, because Joe was, of course, a very red Tory, and he wasn't very charismatic. So I think he was always kind of on the periphery and raising money. He was known as he isn't to this day. He's not a great speaker, but he's got this charisma. It's hard to explain, but Bob Bransford, one of my key sources for the book, just says it's fun to be around this guy, and it really is. It's really hard not to like him. Like people who are polar opposites politically will say, "Well, I love Jerry."
Yeah.
You know, people will, you know, some people I would interview and they would kind of trash him over this or that and the other thing, and then they'd end the conversation by saying, but you know, I love Jerry. Love the guy. And so that was the kind of guy he was. So he had that charisma, and when you have that charisma and you're in a suburban setting, people are going to look to you. And I think that's what happened, is people would mention to him, you know, you should run. And then this nomination opened up because Mark Rose, who was the longtime NDP member, was moving to the provincial side. And that wouldn't have been a sought-after riding for conservatives, because it was historically an NDP seat.
Yeah.
And so he went for the nomination, and he got it. And Mulroney was coming in, and it was an exciting time, so he took off. And I think part of his motivation was, and Bob Ransford, again, his close friend, mentioned this to me, Jerry had this, going back to his childhood, this unrelenting ambition to rise above his humble beginnings. And while he was a successful businessman in Coquitlam, he was kind of small time. Like he was a very wealthy guy, but he wasn't, you know, a Howe Street millionaire. He wasn't in the circles of Peter Brown and those kinds of people. And so this was his chance to rise above that a little further and develop some status. And that meant a lot to him. And as well, I'll just throw in, when he was a policeman, and he gave a little speech at a graduation event. So a municipal councillor come up to him and said, "You're going to be in politics someday." And I think that's probably, obviously he remembered that, so that planted some seeds for him.
So this was a by-election in 1983, right?
That's right.
And this was the same time that Mulroney comes in from, was it Nova Scotia at the time?
Yeah, he was a Quebecer. He was going to bring Quebec back into the Conservative Party and take them to power. But when he won the leadership, there were no Tory seats to open up. So he ran in Central Nova. Peter McKay's dad gave up his seat so that Mulroney could run. And so they ran at the same time. And again, you talk about flukes and luck and everything like that. That was amazing luck for Jerry, because obviously every time Mulroney was written about, the media would mention, meanwhile, on the other side of Canada, this unknown is running for this seat. And Mulroney famously took 3 or 4 days out of his campaign. He and Mila went out to BC to help Jerry, because Jerry called up Brian and said, "Boss, I need you, man," because he was totally unknown out there and he was struggling to beat the NDP. And Mulroney came out, and it was huge. Alan Fotheringham, the famous columnist from Maclean's, went out, wrote a column, and you know, there were big crowds, and Mila is at least as charismatic as her husband back then. Yeah. I remember meeting them around that time, and they would just dazzle people. And so that really got him on the map. You know, he would have been on the front page of a lot of papers standing next to Mulroney, so that that was a big deal for him.
And the two of them, Jerry and Mulroney, they really hit it off, didn't they?
Yes, for sure. They were such similar personalities. I think the big one was they were both from small-town Canada. Mulroney is the boy from Baie-Comeau, you know, Roman Catholic, like Jerry, son of a humble, Mulroney, son of an electrician, Jerry, the son of a trapper, and, you know, they both had some experience with excessive boozing in their youth. They had, you know, they both, as they say in the book, they both married well. They're, you know, they're really great women that they both married. They have very similar backgrounds, similar sense of humor. They're real, you know, men's men kind of thing. They're, you know, back slapping, how's it going, Jer, you know, and that kind of thing. So I think they very extroverted, and they really hit it off. As I said, Jerry has this magnetism. Well, hardly any, no one has more magnetism, really, than Mulroney. I mean, even though Canadians reviled him in his circle, people adored the guy, and they still do, a lot of the people that are close to him. So, yeah, they were perfect. And but also there was this symbiosis, because they needed each other, really. You know, you can't be in politics without having a big streak of opportunism, and Mulroney recognized that this guy was an asset for him, and vice versa.
And you talked to Mulroney in the course of writing this book, and you've touched on this already. This was the, I guess, the Manitoba language issue in 1983, and St. Germain is quite valuable in that for the Conservative Party at the time, right?
Absolutely. Like Mulroney, in his own 950-page biography, talks about how huge it was after he won that by-election and he arrives in the House, and the Liberals, who are, you know, Trudeau's been around for a long time, and they're pretty nervous about this guy from Quebec coming in, because the Liberals always won power based on dominating Quebec, and here's this guy who speaks beautiful French as well as an accentless English, of course, and so the Liberals are nervous about this, so they set a trap, and they introduce a motion the day after Mulroney arrives, calling on the Manitoba government to respect bilingualism and take action to rewrite all the laws into French, because there had been this major court ruling in 1983. Forcing the Manitoba government to do this. And this dated back to an earlier conflict in Canada that involved Laurier back in the 1890s that was also divided Canada badly. And this was just a continuation of this long-standing battle. And, of course, this Manitoba language crisis relates to Louis Riel and Jerry's Métis. So, you know, coming back to 1983, Mulroney comes into the House of Commons, and he's got overwhelmingly Anglophone MPs. And this was at a time when, you know, there was a lot of tension. René Lévesque was the Premier of Quebec at the time, and so the Liberals would have wanted to paint the Tories as, even though they've got this Quebec leader, they're still kind of anti-French. They're still the party that hung Louis Riel, because, of course, John A. Macdonald was prime minister when Louis Riel was hung in 1885. And so Jerry was a kind of a symbol for Mulroney. He could put him out there. You know, he got some coverage in the media, and he could say, look, here's this bilingual guy. I forgot to mention in this interview that Jerry, of course, was spoke French, not fluently, but pretty good, and with a nice accent. And here's this bilingual guy, and he's from Manitoba, and yet he's a Western conservative, true blue conservative, and he's the new face of the party. And that's Jean Charest, who I interviewed for this book. He would have been, like, I think, 24 or 26 at that time. Mm-hmm. He was a very young MP, and he said, Jerry was what we wanted to be as a party. That's the face we were trying to put forward. And so Jerry would go to Quebec and speak for these MPs and tell Quebecers, who were fairly nationalists, this wasn't long after the referendum and not long after the repatriation of the Constitution and the imposition of the Charter of Rights over Quebec's objections. Like, that was very fresh. And so this was a huge thing for Mulroney to be able to, you know, showcase guys like Jerry. I'm not saying it was decisive in any sense. I don't want to exaggerate Jerry's importance, but it's what made him stand out in a crowd, because remember, in 1984, 211 conservatives were elected. Now, how the hell do you get attention when there are 210 people trying to get Mulroney to look at you and say, hey, you know, here I am. So, yeah, it was a very fortunate set of circumstances.
Yeah, and so what this book also does is it gives us a sketch about what's going on in this country in those Mulroney years, especially in the 80s. And because he's from B.C., you get a sense of the relationship between Ottawa and the government at the time. And so in the beginning in 86, you have Bill Vanderzam, the Socred premier, yeah. and the relationship between him and Mulroney and I guess, St. Germain. And you know, there's also, you know, a great number of other personalities involved. And you write about this in the book, about how he dealt with fellow politicians, two that I can think of, Pat Carney and Kim Campbell.
Yeah.
Because I guess Carney is the other, well, there are other BC MPs, of course, but I guess Carney's the most senior one at this point, right?
That's right. She was the heavy hitter in cabinet.
Yeah, and then in 88, coming out of the free trade election, I guess Campbell is elected in Vancouver Centre, and so he has to deal with her, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was kind of... When he was elected in 83, but then re-elected in 84 in the big Mulroney sweep after the by-election, he was, as I mentioned in the book, he was not low in the pecking order, but he was not at the top tier. There was Carney, John Fraser, Tom Sitton, Frank Oberle, maybe one other, and Jerry was kind of after that, so he wasn't going to get into cabinet the first round. But I think he, especially as the caucus chair, he earned Mulroney's trust, and he earned a lot of people's respect. And as you mentioned, Bill Vanderzam comes into power in B.C. in 1986. And that was kind of like, you know, B.C.'s experience. It was B.C.'s Donald Trump experience, because here's this, you know, right-of-center populist, not as outrageous as Trump by any stretch, but he was pretty unconventional. And he didn't follow a lot of the rules. And I think it was very tough for people like Pat Carney to deal with Vanderzam, who was quite erratic. And, he was taking action to prevent abortions. And he was saying outrageous things about the federal government and the legislature. And Carney she's combative. She's a hot-tempered Irish woman. She's the first to tell you that. And she would battle him, and she'd battle Mulroney. I mean, Mulroney and Carney had some legendary feuds behind the scenes, I'm sure. I know that the sparks flew between them. Jerry was Mr. Diplomat. You would never see him get angry in public, and he was a kind of a go-between. I mean, Vanderzam and Jerry were both Roman Catholics, so there was that religious element, too, that they kind of saw eye to eye. And so Jerry became the guy that could go to Victoria and talk to the Vanderzam government. And it so happened that Bob Ransford, I mentioned before, a close friend of Jerry, was one of Vanderzam's close aides. So Jerry had an in with the Vanderzam government, and he helped smooth some of the rough waters that were going on between the two governments. And of course, this is Meech Lake period. This is when Mulroney's trying to get Meech Lake through, and British Columbia, as you recall, was probably the most hostile to the whole idea of accommodating Quebec nationalism. And here is Bill Vanderzam, you know, this populist conservative who once got in trouble for, you know, small-c conservative, I mean, who once got in trouble for, you know, making reference to Quebecers as being frogs. And here he is, you know, facing this flak because Vanderzam accepted Meech Lake in 1987. He put BC's signature on it, and he got the legislature to approve it, and he got a lot of flack for that. So Vanderzam was sort of spitting back at the federal government and dumping on them. And so St. Germain was pretty important for coming in and smoothing things over and getting the two governments to see more eye to eye.
So he's defeated in the 1988 free trade election. But he continues to work behind the scenes. He becomes president of the party, and that's into the 1993 election. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Actually, he continues to be president until 1995.
I see.
So
yeah.
He served two terms.
Yeah. And then into the late 90s, because reform is in now, elects a, most of the MPs, I guess, west of Ontario.
Yeah.
It's a tough time to be a progressive conservative. And so into the late 90s, early 2000s, what's Jerry St. Germain's part in the whole Unite the Right movement?
Well, he was, for up until the time when Jean Charest took over from Kim Campbell, Jerry was a big fan of Jean Charest.
Yeah.
And so I think he knew things were tough. He knew that the PCs, Mulroney's PCs, had just blown up their credibility in Western Canada, and that it was going to be tough. And he also recognized that Jean Charest, being a Quebecer, isn't necessarily going to be the first choice of Western Canadians. But he still believes in him. And Mulroney's behind the scenes, of course, saying, don't worry, Jean's going to be a majority prime minister in two terms. And so a lot of people believe Mulroney, that this Reform Party was a flash in the pan. So Jerry worked very hard to try to keep the party alive, keep it floating, even though there were only two MPs and it was a shell of its former self. He was cutting expenses and letting go staff and everything.
He was driving around Elsie Wayne, right?
Yeah, driving around. Elsie Wayne was the other MP, and she was a very strong social conservative, again, a devout Roman Catholic, and she's from my hometown of St. John, New Brunswick, so I remember her from when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And she fit in. She would have fit in perfectly in the Reform Caucus of that era. And there were rumors at that time that she might jump to Reform, which would have been a big deal for Preston Manning, because that would be the Atlantic Canada beachhead. And she would have been great for him. So I think Jerry was, he kind of followed her around and helped her out and drove her places and everything. And he just wanted to keep her in the fold, So I think he put his heart and soul into it. Jerry is a workaholic. In every stage of his life, he's a workaholic, so he's working his butt off. I don't think he put a lot of work into being a senator at that time, but he just used that position as a senator to help the party, and I know that isn't very flattering about our Senate, but that's the way our system works.
Yeah.
And but then Charest leaves, and who becomes the leader but Joe Clark?
Mm.
And Jerry is not a Joe Clark fan, and Joe is not a Jerry fan, and they did not get along. And so this is very discouraging for Jerry, because he's, like a lot of people, people recognized almost as soon as the Reform was elected that, oh my God, our party is split in two. These are our people. The conservatives would say this. These are our people who have left us. We've got to get them back. Joe Clark's view was they all have to essentially capitulate and accept that they were wrong and come back to us on bended knee kind of thing. I'm exaggerating, but that was, kind of how people looked at it. And Jerry was like, you can't, that's not going to work. Now, as long as Preston Manning was leader, Jerry and any Mulroney loyalist, and Jerry was a Mulroney loyalist at that time, is not going to accept Preston Manning as the leader of the conservative movement, because they hated him, because they just felt betrayed by him, because, of course, Manning ran against the PCs in the 1988 election, which was the free trade election. And if you're a Western small-C conservative, you've historically wanted free trade.
Yeah.
And so they felt they were backstabbed by Mulroney, that he actually cost some Tories their seats in Western Canada, and they felt, man, if we had lost that election, we wouldn't have had free trade, and it would have been Preston Manning's fault.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of bitterness. But as we got closer to the year 2000, we start to see that Manning's reaching out. Manning recognizes he's never going to be prime minister, really, unless the Conservative Party, the Conservative movement unites. And so he's making overtures about letting his leadership go up for a challenge, and Stockwell Day shows up, and I think Jerry at that point said, okay, here's a possibility. Stockwell Day's a conservative from Alberta. He's not Preston Manning. He can speak some French. He's not fluent, but he's pretty good. And so he starts to say, he's part of a group of British Columbians conservatives who were saying, we got to get together, we got to get together. And yet there was this world in eastern Canada that had the blinders on still. Joe Clark was one of them. Brian Mulroney was another one.
Yeah.
Marjorie Le Breton, a whole whack of them. Tom McMillan, the fellow that you interviewed recently, he would have been one of them that says, you know, come hell or high water, we will not join with these guys. They're a bunch of right-wing rednecks, and we don't want any part of them. Pat Carney is another one. These red Tories didn't want anything to do with these reformers from Western Canada who were kind of viewed as kooks and bigots and things like that. And so, but Jerry knew who they were. He golfed with them. They were his friends. And so he said, no, you know, he was constantly telling Mulroney and these people, no, these are our people. We've got to do something to bring them back. And so he finally goes over to the Canadian Alliance. I remember getting calls from people in BC saying, Jerry's going to move. Jerry's going to go from the PC caucus in the Senate to the Alliance. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if he's ever going to do that. But he did it. And that was a huge blow for Joe Clark and the PCs. And especially, in BC is a very important province for conservative movement. And to lose Jerry St. Germain is, I think, probably a lot of people said, okay, this you know, cold war between the two parties is not going to work. And so I think in that sense, he really helped the movement to unite the right to take a big step forward.
By the way, just before all of this, when Charest leaves in, I guess, 98, he goes, he runs that 97 election, boosts the Tory fortunes from 2 to 20-something seats.
Yeah.
He has to go to Quebec now because he's going to be a premier there.
Yeah.
Or he runs for the Liberal leadership, I should say, there.
Yeah.
Jerry St. Germain goes to Stephen Harper and asks him to run for the Progressive Conservative Party leadership. Is that right?
That's right, yeah, 1998. A lot of us, most press gallery journalists, including me, were very impressed with this young guy, Stephen Harper. Harper used to kind of make fun of us over this, but, you know, some of us would refer to stories as the bright young moderate of the reform movement. And he was moderate not because of his economic views at all, but because he was not basically an evangelical Christian, even though he ended up going to an evangelical church. And so, but Jerry saw that. He saw that here's this, I mean, it was a big deal for PCs, and especially Mulroney PCs, to have someone who's bilingual. And Harper spoke decent French. He was on French TV all the time. And so Jerry has a good eye for talent. Like, a lot of the young men that worked for him are now CEOs, and I can think of a couple anyway that are CEOs, and they've done really important things. And Jerry recognized that, and so he went out to Calgary and spent a day with Harper and his wife and tried to convince him, and Harper just said, well, it's not my time.
Yeah.
And it probably wasn't. I think Jerry recognized that maybe it was premature.
And so what's their relationship? Because this goes into now, the right is united, if you will. There's a Conservative Party of Canada with Stephen Harper at the helm. Jerry St. Germain's in the Senate. Through the Harper years, what's their personal relationship like?
Jerry says there were times when he says Harper was calling him daily, especially if he needed an opinion on what was going on in BC and what's support like in BC, what policies, that sort of thing. What should we do about this unite the right thing? I think they had a pretty close relationship, but not in a close way that he would have had with Mulroney. I mean, as Harper joked at Jim Flaherty's funeral, and it was probably the best Harper speech I've ever seen in my life, but Harper was saying about Jim Flaherty, all the friends he has, and all how much Jim's friends loved him. And Harper quipped, I can't even get my own friends to like me. But that's kind of the way Harper was. He's just a cold-blooded guy and pretty ruthless. So I don't think they were ever friends, but it would have been, you know, if Harper would have called up. I wasn't there, obviously, but he'd say, hey, Jerry, hey, Steve, you know, let's talk and all that. It would have been pretty businesslike, and I think Jerry was Harper's guy in BC.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, because, you know, Harper didn't have much of a connection to BC, and he was an Alberta guy from Ontario, and so he needed people like Jerry and John Reynolds and a few others, and so in that sense. But then, I don't know if you want me to jump to this,
yeah,
but they had a bit of a falling out.
2006, when he forms the government, I guess Jerry thinks that he's going to be the guy in the Senate, and he's not.
Yeah, well, Jerry goes back and forth on this, because, and I really had trouble pinning him down, because he says, well, I told Harper I didn't want to be the Senate, because in the Senate, in our system, up in, at that point anyway, the Senate would appoint a government leader who would answer questions in the Senate when they had question period, and he or she would be automatically in cabinet. And Jerry says he didn't want to be that person, but a lot of people say that, and then but they want to be asked, right? Mm. Because, you know, you can't be in politics without having an ego. And he was the guy that, you know, that Harper would ask Jerry, you know, who should I put in my cabinet, and who's good and who isn't, and that sort of thing. And Jerry had said that Harper wanted Jerry, after he won the election, to speak to Gordon Campbell, the BC Premier, and the mayor of Vancouver as well. And so he just thought, okay, I'm his guy. And then when the cabinet is announced, two people are named that are just crushing. One of them is Marjorie LeBreton. Marjorie is named the government leader in the Senate. And, you know, I can explain if you want the rationale for Harper naming her. But for Harper, for Jerry, it was just crushing, because they don't like each other. Jerry had a big problem with Marjorie, because they competed for Mulroney's attention in a way. And as you know, you mentioned that horrible letter that Marjorie wrote to Jerry, accusing of being disloyal and things like that. But also, Marjorie was on the front lines of the movement to discredit Stephen Harper. If any one of us in the press gallery wanted a colorful quote about Stephen Harper, you know, that would be the other side of someone saying something glowing, if you wanted to balance that off, you'd go to her, and she'd say something nasty about Stephen Harper.
Mm-hmm.
And all the while, Jerry's busting his ass to get this guy elected. And then she gets the reward. And it's just like, oh, my God. And you didn't even tell me. You didn't even have the courtesy of... That's what Jerry couldn't accept. Why didn't Harper call him up and just say, look, Jerry, I know you're not going to like this, but here's what I'm doing. And he didn't do it. He found out about it through the news media.
Yeah.
And then a second thing, this has upset more Jerry's people than Jerry, but David Emerson, who is a liberal who fought tooth and nail to defeat Stephen Harper in the 2005-06 election, also gets named as a BC minister. And so here it is, Jerry, the guy that, you know, is a loyal foot soldier going back decades, and these two people that, you know, bump in ahead of him. And it's just like, it was tough for Jerry. And I think he took it personally. He's a very proud man. He's got an insecure streak to him. And Stephen Harper's the kind of guy that would make a lot of people insecure, because he is an extremely smart man.
Yeah.
And Jerry told me of one anecdote back in 2008. You remember the apology for the residential school?
Right.
And Jerry gave a speech at one of those events. I wasn't there at the time. I was based in Paris then. But Jerry gave a speech. It was half in French, you know, nicely expressed French. And Harper came up to him afterwards and said, good speech, Jerry. I didn't know you had it in you.
Mm.
And I'm sure Stephen thought this was a nice compliment.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know what Jerry thought. Okay, up to now, would you think I was an idiot or something, or I couldn't do this?
Yeah.
And so Jerry kind of looked at me when he told me that, and that hurt. That hurt for him. And then the other thing, well, I'm sure we'll get into this later, but the Senate, the Harper having the Auditor General do the audit of
expenses.
The senators.
Yeah.
Jerry took that personally, even though I don't think Harper was going after Jerry.
Yeah.
But Jerry took that personally as a betrayal that that he was using us as scapegoats, even though, you know, all the work we did for him. So, right. So there's that, you know.
So,
I mean, Jerry's a conservative. If mm-hmm. Harper was running again, I think he'd probably vote for him.
Yeah.
But definitely. And Mulroney is the opposite. You know, Mulroney is the guy who calls everybody up on their birthdays. You know, remembers your wife's birthday at the busiest of times. You know, he's just your guy. He's got your back.
Yeah.
And Harper never had anyone's back, as far as I know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if he has any, you know, friends left in politics, other than the people that work for him. So
yeah.
He's just not Jerry's kind of guy.
So you mentioned the Senate expenses scandal, which consumed the country for a long time, until about a year or so ago when the election happened. What was Jerry's place in all of that? I mean, was he one of those people who was questioned in terms of the expenses that he filed?
I have to give you a couple of layers of context before we drop in Jerry, because otherwise I think our listeners will, you know, might not get the big picture here.
Yeah, yeah.
The big picture is the Senate for decades, pretty well for its entire existence, has been a poorly run institution. It costs us $100 million a year. People don't like it because these people aren't elected. A lot of them are, you know, hacks, flacks, and bagmen, as they call them.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry was kind of a bagman. You know, he did raise money for the party and that sort of thing. So it's the Senate has also always fiercely defended its independence from the House of Commons. And it has never been run, it's kind of run by this thing called the Board of Internal Economy, which is controlled by senators. So, and there's also has been this principle through the years that a senator is automatically assumed to be honorable. So when you submit your expenses, the clerk on the other end is taking it, assuming you're honorable.
Mm.
And so there's not a lot of questioning. So it was a poorly controlled, it was kind of like, you know, the hens are in charge of the hen house. And so on top of that, in 2012, which was the year that Jerry retired, we had the succession of scoop scandals where Mac Harb, Mike Duffy, Brazzo, and Pamela Wallin all got nailed in these controversial stories about their expenses, and mostly it was about living expenses. These people that lived in Ottawa were claiming as if they lived outside of Ottawa. And so they were getting, you know, over the course of a year, in the five figures in terms of compensation. And they felt that they were following the rules, but it just the optics were horrible. So this breaks. This is very embarrassing for Stephen Harper, because three of the four people are his very recent appointees from 2009.
Mm-hmm.
After he came in 2006 saying he was going to clean up, you know, these liberals are corrupt, I'm going to clean things up, and I'm going to reform the Senate. And the next thing he knows, he can't reform the Senate, and everyone knew that going in. He can't reform the Senate. Then he names this extraordinary number of senators in the Christmas of 2008, including Duffy, Brazzo, and Wallin.
Mm-hmm.
And all three of them get caught up in this scandal. It's very embarrassing. So to ease the embarrassment, because now you've got Mike Duffy owing $90,000 and he doesn't have the money to pay for it, and they can't pay for it, so they ask, you know, they offer him under the table $90,000 from Nigel Wright,
Nigel Wright, yeah.
And that gets out. So here's a bigger scandal. So here's where Jerry comes in. 3 weeks after the Nigel Wright story breaks, which again, it's like devastating for Harper. Like, this is top of the news every day, as you remember.
Yeah.
This is the biggest blow of his entire career. 3 weeks later, Marjorie LeBreton, who is Stephen Harper in the Senate.
Yeah.
She is not an independent person. She is the PMO's mouthpiece in the Senate. And I mean, I like Marjorie. She's a really nice person, but her whole career has been based on being loyal to whoever the leader is. And so she acts on the PMO's bequest to call in the Auditor General to do an audit that costs $24 million and audits every current and former senator over a two-year period, which catches Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry has no idea he's going to be audited in this. And so they audit him. He gets, and I'm not surprised that he got caught. In retrospect, I was at the time, but looking back, I should have known that he was going to get caught, because he was always one of the biggest spending senators. And it was because, you know, to his credit, he was a hard worker. I told you earlier, he was a workaholic. To his discredit as a father and grandfather, his kids didn't see much of him, and he's the first to tell you that he feels badly about that. But he's day and night, and he was chairman of the Senate Aboriginal People's Committee, and so he was traveling all over the country, running up big expenses, and he was proud of that. He was like, boom, I'm doing my work. And a lot of senators do very little. And so I'm doing my work. I have no problem with this. He thought he was following all the rules.
Yeah.
Guess what? The Auditor General, who clearly had a shaky understanding of Senate rules, because a lot of what he found was later overturned by the former Supreme Court Justice Ian Binney.
Mm-hmm.
But Michael Ferguson, the Auditor General, goes in, you know, $24 million basically witch hunt. Not witch hunt, but you know what I mean. Anyway, he's out sort of looking for whatever, and he finds just under $1 million in questionable expenses, and Jerry's part of that. 30 of the 112 or 116 senators had problematic expenditures. Jerry is one of nine where Ferguson said, there's such a severe lacking of documentation that I'm referring this to the RCMP.
Yeah.
And that's like, in Canadian politics, and I'm going to step back for a second. One of your previous guests, Mark Schneider, talked about how Canada, you know, a lot of journalists like Mark looked back and thought, wow, we're a pretty clean country. We're not very corrupt. Well, it's 100% true. Canadians have no idea how clean we are relative to most Western countries like Italy, France, and the United States. And so for us in the press gallery to have someone as credible as the Auditor General say, this has to go to the RCMP, it's like, oh my God, this is like the biggest scandal there ever was. And so it's huge headlines, and Jerry's just like absolutely crushed. Like, you know, he's just utterly certain of his integrity, and he's devastated by this, and he fights it. And he didn't fight it in a very elegant way. He was a little bit uppity about it, and, you know, kind of this how dare you kind of thing. He ended up paying back about $500 for something that he agreed was inappropriate. But to this day, he insists that the rest of this $67,000 or whatever it was all appropriate. And so so essentially the last 2 years of his life, he feels like all his life's work has been, you know, a shambles, and his integrity has been challenged, and he thinks how unfair it is. And it's funny because, you know, the vast majority of people who I interviewed for this book who know him, they don't even think about this.
Yeah.
When they talk about him, they talk about what he did for Aboriginal rights and these other things. They've kind of forgotten about it, and they don't accept it, that Jerry would have done anything wrong. So, but it eats him up because, as they say, he's a bit of an insecure guy, and he's a very proud man. And so that's been a tough thing for him to deal with.
Yeah, it's such a compelling life story, and so the retirement years. I mean, there was a rough accident, wasn't there, recently?
Yeah, exactly. He was just before this the Senate thing broke, about 6 months or 8 months before. He was out in the backyard with his son, and he was burning some bush and he was using gasoline, and he was in the wrong direction in terms of the wind, and these fumes engulfed him in flames, and he had serious burns. I should have put the photographs in the book, but I never got around to that. But the photographs were horrific. His skin was just bubbling, you know, because he had this synthetic golf jacket on, and the golf jacket ignited and burned his whole, I think it was his left arm and parts of his chest, and his eyelashes and eyebrows were all burned off. And he jokes about it now because he says, I lost about 15 years off my face because it took away all my wrinkles. And when he told me that, I looked at him, I said, my God, you're right. You have no wrinkles on your face.
Yeah.
He says, yeah. He says, I look about 65 now. But, you know, it was a horrific thing for him because here's this hyperactive, workaholic guy who's like, you know, one of his quotes is that he always says is, my feet are moving before I get out of the bed. And he's stuck in a dark room with cold compresses on, and he's freezing because he's lost this whole layer of skin over a big part of his body in the middle of the summer, and he's watching news networks, bored out of his mind. And so he was, and, you know, of course, like any of us, you do something dumb and you beat yourself up. And, of course, he's beating himself up the whole time, like, how could I be so stupid? And so, yeah, that was a tough time. He was depressed, and he admitted he had depression issues over that. So, yeah, it was rough, given, and especially given the time that finally he's retired, he can spend time with his family and relax and all that. And you know, that was a big blow for him.
So how is he today, and what has he made of this book?
Well, he's still as active as he was when he retired. He immediately continued his work with a few extremely bright and accomplished Aboriginal leaders in BC, people like Harold Kalla, who's named in the book. Mm-hmm. He's working on a project to help First Nations raise money to engage in economic development, and because there was this big one of these natural gas pipelines in northern BC that was proposed. There were some First Nations up there that wanted to be involved, but they couldn't raise the money, and because it was a substantial sum, obviously hundreds of millions of dollars, and that was a little band in the middle of nowhere going to do that. And so what Jerry and Harold and these fellows are doing is they're trying to get the federal government to give loan guarantees to these First Nations and also help these First Nations hire professionals to put all these deals together and make sure the environmental research is done and everything like that. And so that has pretty well consumed him in retirement. And he's, to this day, I mean, our book launch in Ottawa is Tuesday, December 6th, and it was going to be about 3 weeks earlier. It was going to be December 7th, and I got this phone call saying, no, Jerry has to be in northern BC on the 7th for one of these events. So that's what his life is like. He's still running around the country trying to do these things, and because he cares. He really, really cares about the welfare of First Nations people.
Now, has he read the book?
Yes. Oh, yeah, for sure. Because I had independence in this book in the sense that, you know, that was an agreement that he wasn't, you know, going to be dictating what was in it. But we had this mutual trust that he knew I liked him and I admired him. And so there's a mutual trust. But I'm a strong believer in having, you know, doing, you know, serious fact checking. So I would send chapters to him and say, is this accurate? You know, I didn't want him to be judging, you know, how I would use a turn of phrase or how I would characterize him. I think the only real change he suggested was twice in one page I referred to him as insecure, and he says, isn't that one too many insecurities? And I was like, yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even notice that. That my editor probably would have taken that out, so thanks. So, but yeah, he read it. I think he's happier about it since people have come to him and said they've enjoyed reading it. I could see both he and Margaret. I'm not sure how sure they were initially, but at the book launch in Vancouver, you know, a lot of people had come to them and said, you know, they liked the book, and they were both glowing. So I think he feels pretty good about it now.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed reading it a lot. I mean, for me, this was just a delight to read because, you know, I follow politics regularly. And you're a guy in particular because I've never been to Ottawa. You're one of the key people in the last couple of decades, at least, who a lot of us in this part of the world rely upon for what's going on there. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today, Peter.
Well, it's been a pleasure too, Joe, and I'm delighted to do this because I've started following your podcast and listening to your interviews, and you do a great job, and you get some really interesting people on. So I guess we're the Mutual Admiration Society right now, but it was a great pleasure for me to do it as well. You're a good, very good interviewer. Well,
thank you very much. The book is called I Am a Métis, The Story of Jerry St. Germain. It's from Harbor Publishing. The Vancouver Sun's Peter O'Neill joined me on the line from Ottawa in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.